Good evening, everybody. Shmuel Platzer coming at you live from Gulf Manor Synagogue and our School of Jewish Studies here in Cincinnati, Ohio. It is Tuesday night and it is July 2nd, 2019, and here in the United States, we're gearing up for the July 4th celebration and weekend. Habo Aleinu Latova, as we say. May it come upon us healthily and well. We're here Tuesday night. This is our Tanakh night. We are continuing our study of 1 Kings. And we have just recently begun the study of chapter 11. We got about a verse or two, roughly a pasuk into it last week. And we didn't really go very far. And so what we're going to do is we're going to start it from the top, and we're going to move through. I didn't write down exactly where we left off. My recollection is we basically did one or two psukim. So, having said that, we're going to do a little review, a little chazara, it doesn't hurt, and then we're going to keep on moving really, really slowly, carefully, thoughtfully through the material. If we get where I want to go, and I think that we will tonight, then we're also going to be able to see the famous Gemara in Shabbos, the Amar Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachmani, the Gemaras where he says, if you think that Reuben sinned, you're wrong. If you think that Eli's sons sinned, you're wrong. If you think that Solomon sinned, you're wrong. Meanwhile, the Torah says they all sinned. So the question is, like, to what extent did they sin? What was the sin? How bad was it? And so on. All right. He's entitled to his opinion. Some of it's on shaky ground. I hate to say that. At least that's how I feel about it. But we'll give him his due, and we'll give everybody else their due as well. Chapter 11, Pasuk Aleph. Perek Yud Aleph, Pasuk Aleph, 11, verse 1. V'amelech Shlomo ahav nashim, again, this is 1 Kings, chapter 11, verse 1. V'amelech Shlomo ahav nashim nochrios rabos. King Solomon loved many foreign women. Oh, also there's Bas Parah, and also the daughter of Pharaoh. And who are these foreign women? Moabios, Moabite women. Ammonios, Ammonite women. Adomios, Edomite women. Tzad Nios, Zidonians, Hittios, Hittite women. A lot of women running around in the king's court. Take a look at the footnote. He loved many foreign women. After having related the story of Solomon's grandeur and success, Scripture proceeds to relate his failures. Like a bracha, that's good. Starting with the account of his buying many horses, a violation of the prohibition, which the Torah placed on kings of Israel, not allowed to buy too many horses. Scripture continues with the account of his marrying many women. Likewise, a violation of the biblical prohibition placed upon kings. And that's to be found in Deuteronomy 17, verse 16, not too many horses. And then verse 17, the same chapter, 17:17, do not have too many wives. In the latter instance, he committed two sins, that of marrying many women and that of marrying foreign women. Can't marry too many, Pasuk says, we assume they're going to be Jewish women. You shouldn't marry too many of them. Then there's also a second prohibition. You shouldn't marry non-Jewish women. He did both. He committed two sins. His rationale is that these two precepts are dependent on the reasons mentioned in Deuteronomy, which is the abundance of horses was forbidden lest it lead the king to return the people to Egypt. And taking too many wives was forbidden lest they turn away the king's heart. Shlomo was confident that he was not vulnerable to either of these weaknesses, and he therefore depended on his wisdom to buy many horses and to wed many wives. Against this, the prophet Jeremiah admonishes, quote, the wise shall not praise himself because of his wisdom. I don't really understand his married life, quite frankly. I've only been married for 12 years, so I'm a rookie. And what do I know? 12 years of married life is like what? It's like, Where are we now? Got married in 2005, and now it's 20. Okay, 14 years of marriage. Okay, that's like not, it's not nothing. It's not 69 years of marriage. We just lost a neighbor here in Cincinnati, Mrs. Adler of Columbus, living with last days living with her married daughter, Susan Shapiro. And Mrs. Shapiro told me during a Nichum Avelim visit this morning that her parents were married for 69 years. That is a remarkable amount of time, and now you're talking like, you know, being married. Almost 70 years of marriage is a remarkable number by any estimation. So I don't have that. But what I have, I have. And I know that, you know, your wife wants your attention and kids want your attention and all that. And I don't know how you could be married to hundreds of women. I don't get that. I mean, like, that means like you're married to nobody. I mean, if you're married to hundreds of women, you're not married. You're just kind of flitting around. You know, hi, how you doing? What's going on? Cup of coffee, you meet this one, and you meet that one. And I don't know. And then before you know it, you bring another stable, another bunch of people, and a new crop is coming up. I don't get that. And I don't think you're, you know, in the sense of being married with your whole heart and soul given over to somebody, that is not remotely possible with five women. Forget about 500 women, and forget about, I don't know, he had a lot more than that, I think. And it can't be done with two. Yaakov had a problem with two women, sisters. I mean, you can't do it. It's just one of those things. No woman wants a rivalry. Shuls don't want rivalry. Schools don't want rivalry. They don't want competition. Women don't want competition. Schools, shuls, and women. They all don't appreciate competition. Nobody does, because it makes you have to work hard. And it makes you have to, and you're going to feel bad. You're not getting enough attention. So I don't get this whole, you know, being married to many, many women. It's just, it makes no sense to me. It just doesn't. I don't know what to make of it. Shlomo was confident that he was not vulnerable to either of these weaknesses. Well, you know, so much for that wisdom. Nobody's perfect. It really boomeranged on him. And we're continuing. Ve'ez bas paro. Tosek says that she gets singled out for special treatment. He was married to a lot of different women and the daughter of Pharaoh. What does that mean? Says Rashi in English, she too is one of the foreign women, obviously. She too is one of the foreign women, but since she was beloved by him more than all of them, she was counted separately. So after all is said and done, he clearly had Jewish women, and he was married to Jewish women and other women, and he liked the Bas Paro the best. She was beloved by him more than all of them, says Rashi. The daughter of the Pharaoh was more beloved to him than everybody. Oh my goodness. I mean, it's just, I don't know, it's kind of stunning. I think scripture tells it to you straight. Similarly, in 2 Samuel, Rashi quotes down, and they were missing of David's servants 19 men and Asahel. We did this last week. But like we said, review is not a bad thing. They were missing of David's servants 19 men and Asahel. See Rashi there. The Sefer continues, and regarding the sin, since she caused them to sin more than all of them. So she's mentioned by name, according to the Sefri, not because she was most beloved by him, but because she made him sin more than all of them. See Rashi on Joshua chapter 2, verse 1, and 2 Samuel chapter 2, verse 30. Similar to the second reason is the Radak's view that the Bas Paro was the beginning of Solomon's downfall, which was accelerated by his other foreign wives. Okay, so she gets special billing. She gets her name up in lights, according to Rashi, because she was the most beloved of all the women, according to the Sifrei, because she caused them to sin more than all of them, and according to the Radak, because she accelerated his downfall. She was the beginning of his downfall, which was accelerated by his other foreign wives. And who are these foreign wives? Well, the Pasuk says it. Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Zidonians, and Hittites. Okay, of these five nations, four had already waged war against Israel, we're told, and some waged war with them later in history. Solomon hoped to cement relations with these nations by intermarrying with them. He may have even hoped that his sons from these wives would lead their mothers nations in God's ways and instruct them to observe his commandments. That was his hope, that he would have children from these wives and they would lead their mothers in the straight and narrow path, and the sons would instruct the mothers on how to live. It's a little shtickel schwer, because like we said last week, how do you hope that your son is going to have some sort of influence over your wife? You should have the influence over your wife. You are the king of Israel, and you should be the one lecturing your wives and saying, listen, you know, honey, that is the old idolatry that you don't do anymore here in Israel. And we're not going to wait around for a child to be born of this union, and I'm going to wait on him to lecture you and give you mussar. That doesn't sound like a winning strategy. But that is the theory that we have. That he may have hoped that his sons would lead their mothers in God's ways, and the sons would instruct them to observe his commandments, according to the Das Sofer. I find that a bit so far-fetched, but that's just me. I think that Shlomo probably had the obligation to sit down with his wives and say to them, we don't do certain things in this court anymore. And apparently he did not do that. We're going to see this kind of clearly coming up very soon. And that is verse 1. King Solomon loved many foreign women, and the daughter of Pharaoh, she gets special billing. Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Zidonians, and Hittites. That's verse 1 in chapter 11. Now we go into verse 2 of chapter 11. Min ha-goyim, from among the nations, Asher amar Hashem al bnei Yisrael lo savo b'hem v'hem lo yavo b'chem, about whom the Almighty told Israel, the children of Israel, you guys should not enter into their camp. Don't enter in with them. Don't mingle with them, as they translated him. V'hem lo yavo b'chem, and they shouldn't come among you. They shouldn't mingle with you. In this way, we avoid his hotness, as we say. We avoid marrying with the non-Jewish tribes. Very important to the Almighty, as expressed in the Torah. Nu achein yatsu es levabchem achrei Eloheim bahem davak Shlomo le'ava. Okay, now this is what the Torah said. Don't you go among them. Don't let them come among you and mingle. Right? Achein, because certainly yatsu es levabchem achrei Eloheim. They will cause your hearts to follow after their gods. That's why I don't want you to mingle with these local people. You got to be separate. Abraham understood that. He sent Eliezer off to his family up in Ramnarayim to get a nice Jewish girl, nice girl from the family, and not a local Canaanite girl. Eliezer said, "No. What if I get nobody in my travels, Asma? Can I bring home a Canaanite girl for your son?" He says, Gevalt, of course not. I'm sending you hundreds of miles to get a nice girl who's hopefully not going to be an idol worshiper. No, and she comes from good stock, from my family. So of course you can't get a local Canaanite girl. No way I want you to do that. Oh, and Yaakov is sent. He's got to get a nice girl. His parents don't tell him to go get a local Canaanite girl. He could have fixed them up much easier. No, he's got to run up to the mishpacha, to Lavan's family, and get a nice girl. He does. That's what's going on. Rabbi, what do you got?
What I want to say is that we have to keep two things separate here. That generally speaking, I think we have Sukhti, we may have had them before, about Shlomo marrying foreign wives. So and there are other places of the Tanakh, in the Tanakh, where figures that we generally would revere are said to have married foreign wives, non-Jewish wives. But the general approach that we use is so they were converted. But here we have a second layer of problem beyond that, right? Because it seems that we have to go through each and every category listed here separately to double check, but it seems that what the point of the pasuk is very explicitly that these are from, right, we can't, even after conversion, you're not allowed to marry. So we don't have that cop out.
Mm-hmm. Right. Wow. But you know, these five nations is amazing. I just want to repeat that very quickly. Of these five nations that were just mentioned in verse four, which was in verse one, four had already waged war against Israel, and some waged war with them later in history. So Shlomo had this theory. Knew the Torah says, you shall not go mingle among them. They cannot mingle among you, for certainly they're going to sway your heart after their deities. Acharei Eloheihem. Don't go after their deities. Don't marry with them. Knew Bohem Davak Shlomo Le'ava. Those were the... Those nations, those are the ones that Shlomo clung to, le'ahava, to love. That is, these are two very strong verbs. I may be a nut, but I'm looking at a verb like Davak Shlomo. He, well, you know, we know that the word that the book means like to glue onto, to stick to. That's a strong verb, right? He clung to, he was clinging to, le'ahava, to love. Now, why are you going to dismiss that verb? That's a strong verb. Because it is. I often wondered. Rabbis always remind us that when Sarah passed, the lights went out in the tent, and Rivka comes in, and the lights come back up. Clearly, this is an Eishes Chayil. You know, she's world-class, Eishes Chayil. Everything is coming, falling back into order, and we're going to have the continuation of Klal Yisrael with Yitzchak and this, and Rivka and so on. And Pasuk says that he lived with her, right? He got to know her and he loved her. And our rabbis always like to point out that you see right here, this is how things are supposed to be. First, you get to know the person. Oh, this infatuation, pre-marriage, it's silly. You only get to love somebody when you live with somebody. That is the refrain that you hear. And you see it echoed in the Pasuk. They lived together, they knew, got to know each other, and they loved each other. So says the Pasuk regarding Yitzchak and Rivka. Now then along comes Yaakov, and we see a little bit of a different paradigm over there, and we see the verb, you know, that he's an ohev as Rachel, and how is that? He's not married to her, and already he loves her, and he wants to marry her, and he's using this, you know, as Rachel Bitra Katana, I want to marry. I worked for 7 years. It's all very romantic. It's a real great movie. But how does that stem? How does the Yitzchak paradigm of ahava, only after living as husband and wife and getting to know each other on a day-to-day basis, how does that stem with the Yaakov paradigm, where apparently it was love at first sight, pure infatuation? I don't know. I was always concerned by that. This is the same verb coming up. And here we have that verb revisiting us, la'ahava. That verb is potent. It's a real, real pregnant verb, if you will. It's full of life in it. He clearly loved these women, right? He married them and he loved them. I don't know if I would have seen that term, but
he loved them and he married them. Now, back to that particular that we have.
I was saying earlier, before you guys came in, I welcome you tonight. You know, when you're married to five women, it's probably pretty challenging, you know, to give each one the attention that she wants and that she gets, I'll pee the Torah. You marry 500 and suddenly you're in a whole different ballpark. I don't know if he had 500 or 1,500. I can't keep track. I don't know what the number is. I know that the number was astounding. And so I suggested earlier that I don't know if I'd call those marriages. I mean, you know, you get a cup of coffee. How you doing, honey? And how are you? And how are you? Everybody okay? Good. I got to go to the court. I'll be back. I'll see another couple hundred. I'll say hello to you guys. And what kind of marriage is that? I mean, what kind of relationships are we having over here? I don't even understand it. I just don't get it, because I am so, and I said I've only been married 14 years, so I know it, I know nothing. But I know that my wife says to me, "Nu, you have some time for me, you're so busy with the shul, you're busy with the kids, you're busy with the law, you're busy with the..." So how about we spend a few minutes chatting about, she's right. She's right. So if you're married to one woman and you're not giving enough attention, it's bad. You're married to 1,500. I don't even understand what that means. I just don't understand it, to be married to 50. I can't understand being married to two women, let alone five, let alone 500. You hear the idea. I don't know what you got. Help me out here.
Right. In terms of the one obligation of the three main ones, that is, you know, a personal thing. If you interpret it, I mean, ona as sex in the narrow sense, I'm sure the Shulchan Aruch and the Halacha says that, as we know, that every husband has a responsibility along those lines to his wife, which whose frequency is
dependent upon
then exactly upon it. Exactly. So when you have multiple wives, I'm sure it's brought down that you divide it up per wife so that the total comes out to the once a week, twice a week, whatever it would be, according to his occupation. So that's how the halacha talks about that. And the wife, remember, the wife has to marry him. That's right. I mean, what else did you do? If you have hundreds, even without any shulchan aruch, well, what's, you're going to divide the night up by the hour? What? In any case, we have to remember that the Torah that we have, my reason I phrase it that way is it may not be evident. From the Pesukim, it may or may not be. But it's very clear when we have a Torah Shebaal Peh that no marriage of an adult woman, in any case, can be compulsive, can be forced. Any woman from age 12 on has the right to say no. So the fact that I don't know, maybe a few of these cases, the girl was alone and the father was some bastard knacker or king or whatever, married her off for diplomatic reasons, can't deal with that, these unknowns and so on. But basically marriage has to be mutual. So if a woman wants to get into that, that was standing the 1,499 other ones, of course, is her problem. Of course, what happens when she's number one, number two, and the other ones come afterwards, I have no answer for that. But in fact, there was a little bit of that, but there was.
Isn't there something else, though, that if you take an additional wife, you're now allowed to use from the first one?
I have not. I don't know any sources that say that. You may be right. You can find me the sources that you must apply.
Isn't that only like fairness, though? I mean, to take on extra women and make everybody
the
suffer.
Of the women that you cannot divorce.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you.
Oh, that's about the rape or seduction.
Not
normally.
But what I'm saying is that's where it comes. I think that's where it comes.
All right, well, we can look it up. I know what you're referring to. One more thing I just want to say. Somewhere, it was probably either in the 70s, maybe in the 80s still, where remember that the Tamani community came to Eretz Yisrael almost 100% within the year or two around 1949. And remember that in Taman, polygamy was totally accepted and not unusual. And in Israel, the rule was made, the law was made, right. But if you've got them, of course, you can keep them. So in the 70s and 80s, there were still quite a few Tamani families who were not necessarily that old. They could have been basically still middle-aged by then, because they married young, who were in that situation. And so I think there was like a two full phrases spread in the Jerusalem Post about that, during interviews and so on.
They got grandfathered in because they were coming with their laws and traditions.
Exactly.
Israel cut them a break. But
exactly.
Moving forward, those
who
are in Israel, we're not going to be allowed to have that privilege.
Exactly, unless they, who knows what they do judiciously, but that's correct. In any case, so they interviewed some of these women, and one of them, I'm bringing this up, they interviewed one who was the older, or at least the longer married of the two wives of this man. I think they interviewed both of them. But the way it worked, at least then, was that each of them have their own house. I think the expectation is if you can't, a man cannot afford to support two women like that, he will not be marrying the second one. But it's not like I've heard with these Mormon cults where, one has this bedroom, one has that bedroom next down the hall, like two siblings or something. Have different bedrooms in the same wing they place, and they take their turns. But no, they had different houses where they raised their children, and they asked the first one, "How did you react when he married the second number of years later. He said, I have a choice. He said, in fact, I actually remade the wedding, you know, the dinner. They asked, why would you do that? Why would I do that? Because if I would have refused, most probably, he would have beaten me up. And she didn't say it in a bitter way, but as an, from what I could tell, an objective matter of fact way. I don't remember if the man was still alive or not. That's the thing I don't remember. Any case, I think so. Otherwise, there wouldn't be, I'm pretty sure, but I don't think they interviewed the women.
It's stated in regards to a
thank you.
A man selling his daughter.
Right.
That's what
it's
stated.
Yeah, but there's a couple other places too. This is the main one, the basic one. He's not allowed to diminish.
All right.
But that's talking about when she, the soul is a minor, and then she matures while she's still there, you know, in the house of her, or up to then master. Then he has three choices, right? And he marries her himself, he marries her up to her son, or to release her. I believe in Confessions of Bed, it says it can't diminish. But that'll, and from there we learn out the law of every husband to every wife. I don't think that there, I'm not aware of any direction or something from there. What was said before when you marry additional women. I could be wrong, but I'm not aware of that.
Okay. Thank you both. Okay. There is a little bit of footnoting going on verse 2. Let's go ahead and take a look, if we may. Of the nations, min hagoyim. Says our footnote, this refers to the Chitim, the Hittites, one of the seven Canaanite nations about whom the Torah cautions, you shall not make marriages with them. That's to be found in Deuteronomy chapter 7, verse 3. And that's a thought of the Metzudas David. Minagoyim refers to the Hittites. Paro's daughter, being an Egyptian, was likewise forbidden. Since the Egyptians are forbidden until the third generation after conversion. Pasuk in Devarim in Deuteronomy chapter 23, verse 8. Another quote in the Stoga. That means that they are allowed to convert. They convert, and then what? They stay among themselves, and they cannot enter in, they cannot marry in to Klal Yisrael for three generations? Is that what that means?
To the best of my knowledge, yes, but with one big broad exception. And that is, they're not allowed to, the way it's halakhically expressed based on the Torah's word, lavo b'kahal. So there's a kal geyer known as kahal, kal amzerim, lodikra kahal. I believe that this is an iser lav, a simple prohibition, that they're not allowed to marry a Jew who has full yichus status, but they could marry a mamzer, they could marry a convert, and then I don't know the children. They only they take the in their case the father status, or they take whichever status is more restrictive. I'm not sure in that case, but I believe that's what it means. Just like today, you have a mamzer. What he's supposed to do when he's allowed to marry a ger or gioris. Whether that's advisable, or another mamzer for that matter, whether that's advisable, whether it's better to coach him to stay unmarried, I'm not sure, but I believe that's what it is.
So if we actually knew today that somebody's status was definitively a mamzer status.
We do.
Right.
We know it all the time.
We know that all the time.
Yeah, sure.
So that person is advised to, when the parsha is relevant, you're saying if and when, then a mamzer is the appropriate spouse for such a person.
A mamzer or a ger
or
anybody. But I don't know if what rabbis today counsel these people. They may, if they're even there, they might say, they might cool it and try to discourage them from getting married, period, because they're going to even mamzer. A mamzer certainly, if the parent is a mamzer, the child's a mamzer. why create Mamzerim? Well, they'll have the same problem when they grow up.
Uh-huh.
You know, I just don't know
okay.
what rabbis, if asked, would say. But the Mamzerim is notwithstanding the details here, and then the shul, the Irish community here, I will go into now, for lack of time, the concept of Mamzerus is, with the non-Orthodox, a lot of people, it depends if you follow the general approach of Moshe Feinstein or of Hankin. If you're following of Hankin, and any relationship between a man and a woman, a Jewish man, Jewish woman, that is considered by them to be a permanent marriage-like relationship is considered marriage in terms of teaching, prior to get, and so on. And unfortunately, how many get married, whether civilly or non-Orthodox marriages or not at all,
mm-hmm.
in the common law, and then they marriage breaks up and then they remarry. Right? So that's obviously Mamzerus.
Right.
And beyond that, well, okay, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein is more lenient in those situations. There are plenty of too many, let's put it this way. But when it comes to marriage, they don't have a problem to use the local Orthodox rabbi going to satisfy the spouse, family, or whoever.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it breaks up, Lo Aleinu, somehow they are not equally eager to break together halacha get. So if you have less of a problem with Rav Moshe than Rav Hankin, but you still have, of course,
I hear. Shkoyach. Must be painful, though, for the rabbi, well, maybe not so much for the rabbi, but for the individual recipient to be told, strongly advise you never to get married and have children, because all you're doing is increasing the mamzerim in the world. Typical person going, I'm never going to have children, I'm not allowed to raise a family, and I can't get find a spouse, and fall in love with somebody, pretty harsh judgment. But at all events, this is what we're up against over here. Also, the Edomites, the Bnei Edom, are governed by this same restriction. Can't enter in until the third generation after conversion. The Moabites and Ammonites are actually not forbidden, he writes, since the Torah forbade only the males of Ammon and Moab. It comes back to the old Sefer Rus Chiddush of Boaz, that it only means males are forbidden to enter Israel. But females are allowed to enter Israel. Females do not fall under the ban. Since these nations were placed under a ban, however, it's proper for the king of Israel, whose children are to exemplify the performance of God's commandments, it is proper for the king of Israel to avoid intermarrying with them, since the continuity of the dynasty depends on the piety of its kings. Who will be the issue of these women? So says the Ralbag. All that, the Ralbag. The Radak maintains, that Shlomo held that if the people of Canaan, including the Chittim, the Hittites, if they converted wholeheartedly, then intermarriage with them was permitted. Shlomo held that if the people of Canaan converted wholeheartedly, then you could marry them. He also held that of the Edomites and the Egyptians, only the males are forbidden. That women are allowed. And that's Rabbi Shimon's view in the Mishnah. Take a look at Yevamos, chapter 8, Mishnah 3. We're told that is Rabbi Shimon's view in the Mishnah, apparently an echo of Shlomo HaMelech's decision.
Well, that has a very big echo already of Boaz, right? With Ammoni Moabi. Not necessarily referring to the others, but since it certainly refers to those two, right, it's not such a stretch to extend it.
Not such a stretch to extend it to the Edomites and the Egyptians.
Mm-hmm.
Once you've established it for Ammon Moab, it's not so far-fetched to extend it on. I would have thought that it's not so pushy to do that if you're not, you know, explicitly told in the Pasuk anything along those lines. We get the impression that Edom and Egypt, they are, third to the third generation. And now we're told over here, according to this, that only the males are forbidden. And that's the Boazian teaching. Okay?
they could go either. You're right. I mean, see, I just said that's such a stretch.
Okay.
I said it could agree either way.
Got it. Okay. Right. For certainly they will teach him yatu. What's the term? Achein yatu is levavachem achrei lahem. Because certainly they're going to sway your heart. Indeed, they will sway your heart. And Targum Yonason says, perhaps they will sway your heart. I want to see that. Dilma Yatun, says the Targum. Dilma, maybe they will. Is that what Achein means?
Yeah.
I thought Achein is a lot more, you know, definitiveness than that.
Okay,
I mean, certainly, yes, indeed, yes.
Okay, Achein no da hadavor.
Right.
They have with Moshe. I all
right.
The tribute meant, you know, oh, it's discovered. Let me get the paragraph.
Surely it has been discovered now, and that's why you ran. I don't think he was saying, you know, maybe this is, you know, going to be found out by the Pharaoh. He's going, I think that certainly, you know, absolutely people know about what I did. Achein noda hadavar. Certainly people know about the deed. So that is my take on the word achein, that it lends itself to a certain definitiveness. Okay. Welcome. We continue. Le'ahava. I'm on a time.
Kushta is the Adavika. Kushta means surely.
Uh-huh.
This is, of course, this is Uncle Listen, that's Yonason, but still, this look at the Yonason, who's shouting at Yonason, and the Chumash, but total opposite.
Thank you so much. Regarding Moshe Rabbeinu's, you know, assessment of what the situation after he killed the Egyptian, the Hebrew there is Achein no da davar, and as Rabbi Brilla pointed out, Uncle says the Kushta, but certainly it is the case that the thing is known. Whereas over here, Targum Yonason is going, well, Dilma, maybe the thing, maybe they're going to sway your heart away and towards the idols. I would have thought that the word Achein, just like it means Bekushta back there in Exodus, it means Bekushta over here too. I am incorrect, according to the Targum Yonason.
Oh, look at what you see in here, the MS. So that everybody agrees to the
Targum Yonason. Right. Thank you, Rabbi Rolof. For sure they're going to sway your heart towards idolatry. So says the Metzudas Tzion. Shkoyach. I feel better. Ahava, to love them, obviously, to love them. According to certain of our Chachamim, and it's going to be Das Sofrim, saying this, according to certain Chazal, there was some personal desire involved in Shlomo's taking these foreign wives. There was some personal desire. Not just geopolitics, in other words. A little bit more.
Forbidden fruit.
Very sweet. Thank you. Right. So according to some of them, listen, you know, that's why he's marrying this one and that one. They're foreign, and he's taking them because he's got personal desire for them. Others maintain, however, no, that his main intention was to bring them under the wings of the Shekhinah and wean them away from their idolatrous practices. That's really very generous. I mean, it's a very generous, a noble thing for a king to want to do, to be confronted by the fact that there are a lot of women out there and they're not worshiping God. And if I could only marry them, if only I could, you know, marry them, oh, I'd get them on the straight and narrow. I don't know. Is that such a winning argument? Yeah, especially if you're hoping and praying that your sons are going to wind up doing that. It doesn't really, it kind of rings hollow or stickle. As mentioned above, Shlomo hoped to cement relations with all the nations with whom he intermarried. He hoped to subjugate them, there's a typo there, he hoped to subjugate them to Israelite rule. It sounds like Islam. And thereby subordinate their heavenly geniuses, is that the word? Under the power of Israel. What word is that? And that word's going to come up again. Maybe it has a second, you know, second definition I know nothing about. But at all events, according to this, he wants to subjugate these women to Israelite rule, make them submit, and subordinate them under the power of Israel. Instead, their intermarriage with him lent them prestige and thereby strengthened their, I guess, I don't know, he said their genius, maybe their protective angel, their, you know, their spirit, their unique spirit, their unique, whatever, in heaven. We may render this term ahava, to love, meaning them, these foreign women, we may render to them did Solomon cleave out of love of God to enhance his, that is God's, prestige. To these women Solomon cleaved out of love of God to enhance God's prestige with these women and their nations. So says the Kli Yakar. Okay, now we continue. And now we're going to get some numbers over here. So here we go. Pasuk Gimel. Vayehi lo nashim soros shvameos. So he had 700 royal wives. Ufilakshim shloshmeos. And he had 300... Is that term again, concubines? You find that word a lot. Means a woman who's not exactly, my understanding, not exactly married, with all the kiddushin and all the details that we always do today in every single marriage that we do. There aren't any concubines out there running around, although a couple of years ago there was some talk in order to lessen the shidduch crisis and get some of these girls off the market. Somebody suggested that we create a concubine, you know, exchange, a market exchange, and have women offer themselves as concubines to their boyfriends on the Upper West Side. I don't know if I should mention neighbors, but I remember it was coming up because there were a lot of women out there not married, and we're trying to get them, you know, under shelter. So somebody was suggesting, how about we do the old concubine thing? I don't know about that. 700 real wives, 300 concubines, Vayatu Nashav es Libo, and his wives turned away his heart. So apparently not the Palakshim, not those concubines who may have felt very uncomfortable shaking any boat at all. Maybe they're just happy to be in the king's palace. But his wives, the royal wives, the ones who got the royal kiddushin and the royal treatment, they're the ones, we're told, who were swaying Solomon away from worshiping the one true God. Mrs. Roloff, did you have a question?
Okay. No, I was going to say, according to dictionary.com, the sixth definition that they list for genius is the guardian spirit of a place.
Then you got it. Thank you. The guardian spirit. For the word genius, thank you very much.
Okay, so on the concubines, were the concubines foreign concubines, or were they all,
I guess we'll never really know.
Foreign wives, but we don't know the concubines.
I'm going to throw in the concubines along with the whole thing.
So how do you know the concubines are not Jewish?
Well, I don't know that for a fact.
But because if you're trying to cement relationships with foreign powers,
you give them the royal treatment.
You don't take them as concubines. That would be tribute.
Yeah, you may argue that. But the opposite argument would be, listen, you know what my daughter is? My daughter is a concubine to the famous King Solomon of Israel. And the typical guy's going, you go, bro. You're the king of Moab, and your daughter is the concubine. So that's great. I mean, to be affiliated in any way with King Solomon, I would think, would be a big deal positive thing.
I'm sure we should Google it to find out.
All I'm saying is, we'll never really know for sure. We got 700 of these, 300 of those, just like the 700 were made up of foreign women and maybe some local Jewish women, probably two, the same thing with the 300. Non-Jewish, yes Jewish, yes this Jewish, everybody's into the pool, 1,000 women. Mrs. Brohmer, what do you got? Nothing? Okay. You got nothing to say. 1,000 wives, 700 real ones, 300 semi ones. They're all in the same boat. They all get the same cup of coffee and treatment in the morning. Hello, honey. How are you? Hey, honey. My buddy used to say to me,
know all our names.
Yeah, you gotta know the names. You can't. I was once on a date with somebody, and I met a rabbi that I knew. I'm telling you, I completely, I mean completely, had a senior moment and forgot her name. And it was an unusual name, and it wasn't a Hebrew name. And I'm going in my head, what's this girl's name? What's this girl's name? And I could not come up with it at the moment of truth. And I said, and this is my friend. And I suppose if the rabbi wanted to know her name, he would have inquired of her. It was a little bit embarrassing, and I don't recall getting a second date. And maybe that was the reason why, because if, when you're going out as frequently as I was going out, it was difficult sometimes to know who are we dating tonight? What's her name? I mean, it wasn't a date tonight, but it was pretty busy. So imagine I'm just dating them, you know, and I got the resume and the whole thing and with name and address and phone and occupation. That's better than Shlomo had, I bet, any given moment. I mean, were they walking around with their name tags on them? I don't know about that.
You should have pulled out of your pocket the note that you had.
Well, I should have done a lot of stuff. It didn't work out. I just completely didn't have that on me. I kind of left that in the car, I guess. I don't know. So it was a very embarrassing moment. At all events, we continue. He's got 700 women flying around over there. Vayatu nusha v'sliba. Can you be medayik? Can we apply Talmudical incisive reading and say, well, the word Nashav comes up. His wives, peeled him away from God and got him into idolatry. Not the concubines. They would never even think of doing that. So scared. They don't want to lose out in the palace. They just say whatever, you know, whatever you want. But the wives who got the royal treatment, they apparently felt that they had power and therefore they were able to have some sway over him, and they got him to, you know, to move off of the, according to this anyway, they got him to go into idols. We're going to see. I got a handout. I don't know if we're going to get to tonight, but we will see what there is to see in the Gemara and Shabbos. At all events, we're told his wives got him off the straight and narrow. Take a look at the footnote on 3. 700 royal wives. Literally, the pasuk says, it says, of course, Nashim Sarot, or Nashim Saros, princely wives, wives princesses, is how you guess. I guess you could translate that. Wives princesses, Nashim Saros. These were women whom he married according to the law of the Torah, with Kiddushin and Ksuba, the marriage contract. They had the status of princesses, but they were not necessarily queens. He did not live with them more than once if they did not suit him. Sounds like a hashverer, Shlahabdo. I mean, am I crazy? They would tell Pasuk says they'd come at night, and in the morning they checked out.
But they weren't married.
But they weren't even married over there in the hashverer. Over here, he is married, and he gets married and doesn't live with them more than once unless it suits him. Is that what the Torah wants from this whole arrangement? I didn't think so. It was what we were saying earlier.
It could be. Okay. So after that, he decided, yeah, not for me. But he didn't divorce them because this is their own.
She would not have been able to marry anybody else.
Yeah.
So she stayed within the confines of the palace, not really having a married life with him anyway, and not being able to marry anybody else anyway. So this was a better thing, to stay married and be married to the king. How you can determine she's not for me after one night, I don't get the whole thing. I just simply don't, because weren't you supposed to go out on the bashal? Weren't you supposed to sit in with the potential in-laws, the machatonim, and get to know the kawa and chat a little bit? And from there you know whether you like her or whatever. Anyway, so he didn't live with them more than once if they didn't suit him. That makes no sense to me. In the Song of Songs, Shlomo himself says, there are 60 queens. That is in Song of Songs, chapter 6, verse 8. According to the simple meaning of the verse, this refers to those wives with whom he lived fairly regularly. 60 wives. According to the simple Pashup Shot, this refers to those wives with whom he lived fairly regularly. They are designed, well, I don't like that word, but they are, I would just simply say, Parshat, they are called queens. Those, because he looked upon them as his real, genuine wives. So he's got 60 queens. He's got 60 wives. Out of 700 real wives, he's got 60 really, 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 really real wives. Great. And 300 concubines. Let's see what that says. These were women the king took without kedushin or ksuba. Just as with his wives, he did not live with all of them, but as the verse from Shira Shirim says, and 80 concubines and damsels without number. Not it's in Shira Shirim, but okay, 80 concubines and young ladies without number. In other words, it says, 80 were his favorites with whom he lived, and the damsels without number were the neglected wives and the concubines. So that's the 700 minus 60, or, if you will, the 640 neglected wives, plus the 220 neglected concubines. I'm running low on the math. It's like in the 800s. He's got 200 he likes, and 800 or so he doesn't like. So that's quite kind of sort of how it's shaping up over here. He liked 60 wives, and he liked 80 concubines, and that's 140, and 860 are kicked to the curb, but they're still on campus. Wow. And his wives turned away his heart. Even during his youth, they turned away his heart, it says. Now, don't wait for like the elderly days. That's when you and I thought it happened. When he turned 60, 70, 80, 90, oh, they're really playing with him and they're swaying him away from God. It's because he's older and he's unable to stand up to him. No, according to this, this is the Malbim. According to Malbim, even during his youth, they turned away his heart. But not to the extent of condoning idolatry. They did influence him, however, concerning minor infractions of the law. I don't know what that means.
Like
marrying so many of them. I don't know, maybe... What's right? What's a minor infraction of the law? Who can know? Tough to know that. Okay. Now, I've been asked to come back to end the year at 8:30 sharp. So it's 8:24. We have a few seconds. This pasuk is absolutely shocking. And you need to know this pasuk for the Gemara that I'm going to give you for a handout. Your homework will be to look over the art scroll on Gemara Shabbos 55b, Amar Shlomo Nachmeini. Anybody who thinks Shlomo sinned is off his rocker, here's why you're wrong. And he's going to argue aggressively that ain't no way that Shlomo sinned in these matters of idolatry. You'll have the handout in a moment. Here we go. Pasuk Hey. Vayelech Shlomo achrei Ashtoreth Elohei Tzidonim. Shlomo went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians. Vachrei Milcom, and after he also went after Milcom, Shikutz Ammonim, the abomination of the Ammonites. Strong language. He is running after this abomination and that idol. And the Torah seems to, the author of our scripture seems very clear. I skipped four. Oh my goodness. I'm so sorry. Apologies are in order. So it was at the end of Shlomo's life, at the time of his old age. His wives, and we're going to be Medayik, he had 700 wives and 300 concubines, 1,000 women. So out of these 700, he liked, 60. So Nashav, his wives, Hituas Levavo, caused his heart to deviate after Achrelim Achem, after other gods. These women caused him to follow other gods. V'haya Levavo Shalem, in Hashem Elokav, and his heart was not whole and complete with the Almighty God, Kilvav David Aviv, like his father had with God. And his father had a shalem, a heart that was lev shalem with Hashem Elokav, with God as God, but Shlomo, the son, was lacking that. He did not have the same heart relationship with God that his father David had. Take a look at...
Here it says in his old age.
That's true. Here it says in his old age. So, you know, what does that mean? Pasuk says his old age, and why does the Malbim say even during his youth they turned away his heart?
Well, what deeper Hamasu does that Malbim?
Oh, we don't have. I don't have a Malbim in my.
Oh, I do.
Oh, you do.
But,
so it would be. And his wives turned away his heart.
In Gimel. Yeah, that was it. But I do that a little ago, when Pasuk says they turned his heart away, right?
Right.
So the Malbim says that that was true also in his youth. However, with this difference, says the Malbim, that in his youth, he still uses an expression, "Omat Tambobo." In other words, he still held something in Yiddish, held Hazich or something. He still had a certain amount of an independent a spirit or merit, to say in Hebrew, to partially. Withstand that. And therefore, the straying which took place during his younger years was only with light sins. Comma. Avobat comes the next passage, passage Dalit 4. And then he says, a minute, I skipped, turn two pages. Let me see where the mama. Right. So when he became old, then the amount of straying increased or strengthened until it reached the level of mama of Avoda Zara. See, the mama is following his typical approach of not wanting to say that one word, phrase, or pasuk is just kind of laying out a foundation or a generalization, which will be later limited or explained in more detail, but that each part is giving some sort of a chiddush. So there were stages. First, it was a minor deviation, but did not reach a level of Bodhisattva. Then later, it did. That's the Malbim.
Thank you. Thank you, Shikara, for that. Thank you so much. Now, here I am with a dilemma. I've been asked by my wife to come home precisely at 8:30 when the shiur ends, and it's more or less 8:30 right about now. If we were to continue, I've got an extremely long footnote over here in Pasuk Daled, and we need a little bit of time to hash it all out. We don't have that time. So in lieu of that, I'm going to give you your homework assignment to look over the next few psukim, and here it is. Here's the handout. It's in Shabbos, Gemara Shabbos 56b. Everybody gets a copy if you'd like. You've got the original Hebrew on the very, very back page. So you can see the Gemara and Rashi Tosfos over there as well. And you'll be able to see the famous Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachmani, his a position that anybody who thinks that Solomon sinned is just making a big mistake. So we're going to see his argument, God willing, next week. There's your hand up. Enjoy. I'm sorry? He is consistent. He's consistent, that's true. He says it about Eli's sons, says it about Reuven, says it about David, says it about Shlomo, says it about everybody. If you think that these people in the Tanakh sinned, you are sadly mistaken. And he strenuously argues, and he does his best. So we're going to see how he does it, God willing, next week.
With Eli's sons, it's a little hard to argue.
And well, he tries his best.
Because
he knows what he can.
Because Hashem decreed.
Thanks so much. All the best. Have a good week.